Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. This is a quote. The Europeans flocking to America are generally the most stupid sort of their own nation. And unless they are turned away, they will soon so outnumber us that the English language would be imperiled. That was written in 1753 by none other than Benjamin Franklin, considered a founder of the United States and oftentimes portrayed as one of the more tolerant founders. It goes to show that anti-immigrant sentiments in this country go way back even before the founding of the Republic. Today we are going to be in conversation about the history of anti-immigrant sentiment and policies towards white Europeans in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. My guest is Daniel Okrent. Daniel Okrent is an award-winning author, historian, and journalist. His latest book is called The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. It is from this book where I got that quote from Benjamin Franklin. Daniel Okrent joins us via Skype. Daniel Okrent, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
It's my pleasure myself.
So you dive into the time period, the late 19th century, early 20th century, in other words, late 1800s, early 1900s, with this book. What is significant about this time period, and where are the immigrants coming from?
Well, the enormous immigration from Europe, from Eastern and Southern Europe, begins around 1890. By 1895, the stream has become a flood, and it stays at that level or even increases for a period from 1895 until the passage of the law that my book concludes with. They're coming from Italy, from the Russian Empire, from Romania, really Poland. If you were to draw a line to the east of Germany, that's pretty much it. Or you could, it's really the lands between the Baltic and the Mediterranean, another way of looking at it.
Today, we see people that come from, whether it be Ireland, Eastern Europe, wherever it comes from, Europe, as being white Americans. How were these people coming from these places throughout Europe were viewed at that time?
Well, they were viewed as virtually an alien race. And in 1895, when Senator Henry Cabot Lodge introduces the first bill that is designed to cut down on the immigration, particularly of the Eastern European Jews and of the Italians, he's very forthright about it. And he says that the law that he is proposing, which was a literacy test, was the heart of it, would continue to allow those from Scandinavia, Germany, and the British Isles to come into the country unimpeded, while affecting those people come from the East and the South.
Can you tell me more about who was Henry Cabot Lodge?
He's the first person to actually use the title Senate Majority Leader. He was a senator from Massachusetts for 30 years, one of the most powerful figures in America in the period from the 1890s into the 1920s. He's probably best known for single-handedly stopping Woodrow Wilson's dream of the U.S. joining the League of Nations. But long before that, at the same time that he was a leading advocate of voting rights for blacks and supported various other liberal causes, he was a violent xenophobe, a violent anti-immigrationist, and he simply wanted to keep these people, whom he saw as inferior and had no problem defining in public as inferior, from coming into the country.
That's interesting, and I think this is an important point. And I meant to bring this up in my introduction, that anti-immigrant sentiment has come from both sides of the political spectrum, both a conservative and a progressive view in politics.
It's really kind of shocking. One of the key figures in the book is a man named Joseph Lee, who was known as probably the first citizen of Boston. He was a very wealthy man who devoted his life to philanthropy, to good works of the kind that all of us would hail today. He even was responsible for keeping the schools of Boston open at night so that the immigrants in the city could learn English. He brought doctors into the schools. He introduced all sorts of good government laws into the legislature. And at the same time, he was writing letters to friends that said such things, if we don't stop this immigration, we will turn into a Dago nation. To another friend, he wrote, "Soon Europe will be drained of all of its Jews, to its benefit, no doubt, but not to ours." And this is a man who considered himself and was a socialist progressive.
That was Joseph Lee you're talking about?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who was also for voting rights for blacks.
Yeah, well, Lee and Lodge both. But Lodge was kind of a mix of conservative and liberal, but by today's standards. But Lee was an entirely, he was a progressive in every sense of the word.
Am I right to say we could also throw in W.E.B. Du Bois?
Well, to a degree. I mean, what Du Bois believed in was eugenics. And that's really, my book is, it's two stories brought together. One is the anti-immigration movement, which Lodge starts, and that for 20 years gets nowhere until it hooks up with the eugenics movement and begins to use the so-called science of eugenics to argue that the Eastern and Southern Europeans were inferior. What Du Bois believed in was eugenics. He believed in the so-called talented tenth among African Americans, and he even featured in his magazine, The Crisis, a eugenic family of the month that had better genes than other families.
All these guys are from Massachusetts. Why is Massachusetts so important in this story?
Well, at the time, in the 1890s until the 1920s, certainly until World War I, it was really a seat of both political and economic power in the U.S. and certainly intellectual power. Yet they had a lot of help from a lot of wealthy New Yorkers, and the merger of the eugenics movement and the anti-immigration movement takes place because of a book by a man named Madison Grant, the founder of the Bronx Zoo. He's the man who saved the California Redwoods, and there's indeed a forest preserve in Northern California named after him. But he published a book called The Passing of the Great Race, in which he put together the eugenic argument and the xenophobic argument. He divides Europe into three so-called racial groups, the blonde, tall, wonderful Nordics, the somewhat acceptable Alpines, and the short and swarthy Mediterraneans. And he actually writes, you know, science has proven that the intermarriage of any two groups will revert, its offspring will revert to the lower group. Therefore, he says, a marriage between a Nordic and an Alpine will yield an Alpine. A marriage between an Alpine and a Mediterranean will yield a Mediterranean. And the marriage between any of the three European groups and a Jew will yield a Jew. And this was the heart of his argument.
I think what's important to know is this all comes out of important advances in science, in particular the work of Charles Darwin, who in 1859 would come up with his theory and publish his theory of evolution.
It's an odd thing. Darwin himself was never a eugenicist, although the man who started the eugenic movement, Francis Galton, the gentleman science of the same era, was in fact Darwin's first cousin. But what Darwin did is he upset the entire received view of the origins of mankind. If we don't all come from Adam and Eve, as had been believed before, then we are not all brothers. We are not related to one another. We come from different places. And if we come from different origins, then there can be a hierarchy of origins, that people from here are better from people from there. And once you have hierarchies, you then have discrimination. And that manifests itself in the eugenics movement around 1910. That's by 1921, there's an article that appears in, of all magazines, Good Housekeeping, that says, now that science has proven that these people, the people from Eastern and Southern Europe, are inferior, we must pass laws to keep them out. And the author of that article was Calvin Coolidge, a month before he was sworn in as vice president.
That's interesting to me, the story about Adam and Eve and the idea that we all came from Adam and Eve, regardless of who you are, because science eventually would show that we all do come from the same place and that we all come from Africa, the continent of Africa. So it's a bit funny to think that with the beginning ideas of evolution, we first started moving away from this idea.
Well, one of the only things worse than not having any science is having just a little bit of science. That's what, you know, the things that, you know, Darwin was brilliant and he knew many things, but he didn't know a fraction of what we know today.
Can you tell me more about his cousin, Francis Galton?
Galton was another man who never worked a day in his life, who was the classic definition of a gentleman scientist. He actually made some very important discoveries. It was really to him we can trace the notion that fingerprinting is an effective form of identification. He made many contributions to statistical theory, but he came up with this idea of eugenics, in which he basically said, taking a line from Shakespeare, that nature is more important than nurture. And if you are born with the right genes, you are going to be a valued member of society. And if not, you will not be. Now, he did not make racial distinctions, but he did, as early as the 1870s, 1880s, he proposed that in Great Britain that they find the 5,000 genetically superior young people, put them in arranged marriages, all of these marriages to take place at once in Westminster Abbey with Queen Victoria presiding, and then each of these couples would be paid an annual stipend so they wouldn't have to work and could instead keep themselves busy and productive by making better babies for Great Britain. And this loony idea crosses the ocean around 1900, and then around 1910, it begins to become a deformed version of even that. And the distinctions between people are not, well, these are smarter, these are stupider, these are, you know, taller, these are shorter, but it becomes a racial determinant. And that, as Grant tries to argue in his 1915-1916 book, we know that the people from Eastern and Southern Europe are inferior.
It's from Francis Galton that we get this idea of nature versus nurture?
Well, the phrase, you know, it's interesting. The phrase nature versus nurture comes from Shakespeare. It's in The Tempest, talking about Caliban. But it was Galton who used it in this new context of the argument of the human being is shaped more by one than by the other.
So Caliban in The Tempest is this resident. I say resident. I can't quite remember if he's human, almost human, hash, wild beast, who resides at this abandoned island. How did Shakespeare use this term?
Well, it's in Act 4 of The Tempest that Prospero describes Caliban as, this is the direct quote, a devil. A born devil on whose nurture can never stick. In other words, his nature was defining him, and however he might be nurtured, it wouldn't make any difference. And that was the idea that Galton used as the core of his eugenic belief, that nature, that which is inherited, is predominant in its influence on human beings over nurture or any environmental influences.
That's very interesting. So Francis Galton got that from Shakespeare.
He took the two words from Shakespeare and then put them into the usage we know them today.
Now, early on, you said Charles Darwin was not a eugenicist, and we'll talk in a moment about what eugenics is, but you said Charles Darwin was not a eugenicist, but he did praise early on the work of Francis Galton.
Yeah, he reads his cousin's book, and he's kind of knocked out by it. He finds that it opens his eyes to a way of thinking about things, really looking at human evolution, which he had not addressed in The Origin of the Species at all. That comes 10 years later when he begins to talk about humans. And so this was just another element that was put into the cauldron of his thinking. But he'd never at any point in his life embraced the entire idea as being the superior idea to any other in terms of the development of human beings.
Would he intellectually move away from Francis Galton?
Well, he didn't live long enough to see what Galton and his followers did. I would like to think he would have not embraced it, but of course that's pure speculation.
I remember many years ago we did a show about the debates between Charles Darwin and Louis Agassiz of Harvard University about whether all people were the same species. And Darwin, who is his ancestors were abolitionists in England, was on the side of saying they're all the same species, where Louis Agassiz was trying to make the argument of saying that different ethnicities are different species. Did you take up Louis Agassiz at all?
Barely, but what's interesting is that Agassiz, who was the most prominent natural scientist in the U.S. in the middle of the 19th century, and really a huge, towering figure at Harvard, he married into the Cabot family, namely the same family that Henry Cabot Lodge came from. So there's a connection from generation to generation.
That's interesting. Is there also a connection just to what we term, and is this what you are also diving into, scientific racism?
Well, yeah, scientific racism is the term that was developed to refer to those people like Madison Grant and his followers who purported to have scientific evidence that certain people from certain ethnicities were biologically, genetically inferior to other humans from other ethnic groups. And that was the core of the entire campaign to restrict immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe.
And then also Gregor Mendel gets into this story, who is not of this time, but his papers are rediscovered.
Well, this is back to the notion of a little science is a dangerous thing. Mendel does his work in the 1860s. He's an invisible, unknown Moravian monk. And in 1900, the papers that he had written explaining his experiments with pea plants that demonstrated the nature of genetics, really. Those papers are discovered in 1900, and the American eugenicists seize upon these as proof, as evidence. And, you know, what Mendel was trying to determine was, could one gene determine the color of the blossoms on a pea plant? That was called a unit characteristic. If both parents had that gene, both of the plants that preceded had that gene, then you would have the result of that matching in the color of the pea plant. Now, Charles Davenport, leading American eugenicist, took that idea of the unit characteristic and applied it to human intelligence, to human morality. An example of a unit characteristic among humans is colorblindness. That's one gene. But the rest of us, we're made up of God knows, you know, we've got entire genetic laboratories trying to determine who each of us really is. And it's not dependent on that single on-off switch that Mendel had identified.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with award-winning author, journalist, and historian Daniel Okrent about anti-immigrant sentiment towards white Europeans in the late 19th and early 20th century. His latest book is called The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Daniel Okrent, before we get into Charles Davenport, who's also an important player in this story, let me ask you about what is eugenics. And my understanding is this is a Greek word in origin that meant good stock.
Yeah, from good stock. And it's not really a Greek word. It's the English adaptation of Greek roots and adapted by Francis Galton to define the so-called science he was in the process of developing.
Was that word ever used in any kind of that way in Greece or even ancient Greece?
No. There are two different Greek words, one that is good and one is stock or origin, that combine into this new word that he invented. And it's interesting that you do bring up Greece, though, because in fact some of these ideas show up in Plato. Makes very clear assertions about there being people of better what we would call genetic upbringing, and that the Greek Republic, the Republic of Athens, should be nurturing them putting them in leadership positions.
Yeah, I am no philosopher, but it's my understanding that the Republic, Plato's Republic, may not even be properly titled anyways, the translation into the Republic, but it certainly wasn't no Republic that we would recognize. It was quite a...
Not at all. But, the same kind of erroneous ideas that infect our politics today, they were present then too.
Yeah, and the idea there was the government should control who reproduces.
That's right, and that was the idea that Galton picked up on, and then that the scientific racists of the 1910s and 1920s used to very great effect, really to sanctify, to clean up the obvious bigotry that Henry Cabot Lodge and others had invoked. You know, they Lodge tried to get his law enacted for 20 years, four times presidents vetoed it, and was always, this is not the American way. We don't put one group above another. But then when the eugenicists come along, the scientific racists, they say, wait a second, this isn't a matter of prejudice. It's not that we dislike these people. Science has proven they're inferior.
And so basically eugenics, we could say, is promoting the reproduction by people who are considered to have superior genes and trying to stop people who have inferior genes from reproducing.
Right. There's positive eugenics. Let's find the best, have them breed with the best. And there's negative eugenics, which is let's have the worst, the least of us, not reproduce. Now, Davenport, the key American scientist in this movement, he began directing that toward people of particular debilities, the blind, the deaf, epileptic, any number of other genetic perceived shortcomings. But then his ideas were then applied to not to individuals in the immigration question, but to the residents of entire nations.
Yeah. And even the state of California has a sordid history when it comes to this and sterilization of people. Okay, let's talk more about Charles Davenport. He's an important part of this story. It's the relationship between Francis Galton in England and Charles Davenport and how the eugenics movement comes from Europe to the United States.
To a degree, Davenport, who was really an esteemed natural scientist, and much of his work, very, very important in the development of plant genetics in botany, respected figure. He catches on to what Galton's up to in the 1890s, and he virtually as a pilgrim goes to meet Galton, and he worships everything that Galton does. He cherishes a photograph of Galton signed by Galton that he's given, and then he brings these ideas back to the U.S. and they start in a rather benign form, and then they get to take a genetic term. They are mutated into something quite hateful.
What is the connection between Charles Davenport and Henry Cabot Lodge then?
Lodge, as I said, Lodge spent 20 years from 1895 until 1915 introducing the literacy test that would keep out Eastern and Southern Europeans into Congress. And four times it passed Congress, and four times presidents vetoed it. And each time they're saying, well, this is discriminatory. That's not the American way. And it's not until Madison Grant picks up Davenport's ideas, which are themselves a distortion of Galton's ideas, which are themselves a distortion of Darwin's ideas, so four times distorted, Madison Grant picks them up and weds them to the anti-immigrant argument. And from that point forward, it's now respectable. It's science that says that Eastern and Southern Europeans are inferior and we need to keep them out.
Congress would override presidential vetoes, correct?
Well, they failed three times. The fourth time, when Wilson vetoed it in 1917, Congress did override the veto. So you had your first restrictive immigration law aimed at people who were white. There had been horrible anti-Asian discrimination laws that had been in place since the 1880s. But this is the first time it turns toward Europeans. The law that is enacted and over the Wilson veto in 1917, however, it is not nearly as effective as they hoped it would be. Lodge knew in 1895 when he introduced it that education levels in Eastern and Southern Europe were quite low, so the likelihood of people passing literacy tests was quite low. By 1917, when his law is finally enacted after 22 years of effort, education levels in Eastern and Southern Europe have progressed substantially. And suddenly, these people are passing the literacy tests, and they're getting in. So the anti-immigration caucus in Congress, which is growing in size, has to come up with something else. And that's the 1924 law that is in place for more than 40 years that effectively ended meaningful immigration from Italy, from Greece, from Romania, from Hungary, from Poland, and from Russia.
What is this 1924 law?
The Johnson-Reed Act establishes quotas. To put it as simply as possible, It was based on the number of people from a particular country who were already in the U.S. So if 10% of the American population was from country A, then 10% of new immigrants could be from country A. And if 2% was from country B, then 2% of the immigrants could be from country B. Now, first, they put in a ceiling on the number of immigrants. Immigration from Europe had been over a million, more than a million around 1907. They put in a ceiling of 160,000 immigrants a year and then these quotas by country. Now, how do you determine what percentage of the population comes from a particular country? Well, you turn to the census. But they didn't use the 1920 census because by then there had been so much immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe that their numbers were up. Nor did they use the 1910 census or the 1900. They actually had the temerity to go back and use the 1890 census, the census that counted the ethnic origins of Americans before the large immigration had even begun from Eastern and Southern Europe. So it was patently discriminatory, and the consequences were, in the case of Italians, as many as 220,000 Italians had come to the U.S. In a single year before the 1924 law, and the new quota allowed fewer than 5,000 to come in.
Sounds like trying to revert back to a previous time, almost like Make America Great Again. Did they have a slogan for that?
It's very much like it. And what it's interesting. One of the terms that Lodge and his fellow Boston and the Northeastern aristocrats used to describe themselves, all of them of stock coming from the British Isles, they called themselves Native Americans. An interesting, different version of that term than the way that it's used today. Yes, and they were very open and plain about it. We want America to be that America that we knew before the incoming hordes, the teeming hordes from Europe.
Was it easily passed in 1924?
It walked in. The only opposition to it, pretty much the only opposition, came from members of Congress who came from the large cities where there were large ethnic populations. But even there, it's a very unpleasant realization. You take someone like Fiorello LaGuardia, who represented the most ethnically mixed congressional district in the nation on the east side of Manhattan, who was himself half Italian and half Jewish. And he, of course, argued very strenuously against this law, but then went on to say, now, of course, it makes sense to keep Asians out because they're different. But we Italians, we Jews, we Greeks, we're like you. We're white. So that even some of my liberal heroes, they did not distinguish themselves terribly well during this debate.
That would include organized labor.
Yeah, organized labor was always, and I think we could say is always, against open immigration. They are right when they argue that open immigration lowers wages because you can bring in people from other countries who are willing to work for less money than Americans are. So if you're a member of the labor movement, if you're Samuel Gompers, really the key figure in the founding of the American Federation of Labor, himself a Jewish immigrant from England, you don't want any of these people coming in. You don't want them competing for the jobs that you are trying to hold on to and increase wages for your members.
With the 1924 quota law and even the literacy test that preceded it, did this just apply to European immigrants coming to the country, or did it also include immigrants from all over the world, including Asia and Latin America?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that virtually every country was given a quota, but the quotas from Asia and from Africa were very, very low. In Asia, by way of illustration, the entire Indian subcontinent was given a quota of 100. But there was an interpretation of the law that even those 100 had to be whites coming from Asia, from India, and a Supreme Court decision in 1923 established that people from India were not white. And how this was established is beyond understanding, but it was established in the arguments in the case to such a degree that even Louis Brandeis, the great liberal hero, Oliver Wendell Holmes, they both agreed with this. And the man who brought the suit, who had been in the U.S. Army during World War I, he had his citizenship taken away from him because he was not deemed white. The under the naturalization laws of 1870 and then of 1910, I believe, you had to be white or black to be a citizen of the United States if you had come from somewhere else to gain citizenship. If you were Asian and born here, you had birthright citizenship. But an immigrant Asian was not eligible for citizenship in 1924.
The 1924 quota law would remain in law until 1965 with the passage of the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act. That 1965 law is very important. Oftentimes when we think about laws at this period of time, we think of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. There are actually three laws that were really important, including this immigration one, sort of three pillars of what was happening in the mid-1960s.
Well, the immigration law, the change, it's very much connected to the civil rights movement, I believe. There are really two primary influences in the 1965 law that Lyndon Johnson signed that got rid of all ethnic requirements or ethnic limitations in immigration to the U.S. One factor was that the Eastern Europeans, in the years after the erection of the Iron Curtain in the 1940s, the Eastern Europeans became valorized. They were celebrated. They were the poor victims of Soviet communism and its reach over Eastern Europe. So when we made heroes of those who were fighting against the communists in Hungary and in Poland and other countries, we had to encourage them to come here. We had to believe that it was important for them to have freedom. And that meets up with the civil rights movement, which is establishing, obviously, at the same time, the equality of man, of men and women, that we are all the same, that we have should have the same inalienable rights. So those two streams come into a confluence of a law that finally gets rid of the 1924 law.
Daniel Okrent is the author of the book, The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. He joins us for a conversation about the anti-immigrant sentiments and laws against white European immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th century. Daniel Okrent, can you talk to me about the role of big money in this anti-immigrant and eugenics movement during this period of time, and in particular, the Carnegie Foundation?
Well, the science, the so-called science of eugenics, needed support, and the support came from a few primary sources. One was the Carnegie Institution of Washington, now known as the Carnegie Institution for Science, which is not the Carnegie Foundation, but it was another benefaction that was set up by Andrew Carnegie, himself an immigrant, even if from Scotland. And he finances the first laboratory that Charles Davenport sets up in Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island. And the Carnegie Institution remains connected to it for more than 30 years. But the real dollars come in 1910 from the estate of the railroad baron E.H. Harriman. His widow, who is the richest woman in the United States after her husband dies and she inherits it all, she sets up Davenport in his laboratory and in his various researches that went way beyond Long Island. And it becomes the individual who pays for the whole thing as late as 1918, 1919. So, you know, there was also money that came from the Rockefellers and other well-off individuals who became involved at first because they wanted to improve the American population. But it had nothing to do in their minds at first with what country people came from. It was simply the eugenic idea that, stutterers shouldn't reproduce or some insane thing like that. It was not aimed at ethnic groups. But the support from particularly from the Carnegie groups and also from the Rockefellers, that begins to evaporate with the rise of Hitler. And they suddenly realized, my God, look what we've done. It's the science that we have created, that we have endorsed and sponsored, that is being claimed as science by the Nazis to justify their racial views and their racial policies. And in the mid-1930s, these organizations that have been supporting the eugenicists for so long, they run as if running away from the plague.
Are the Nazis relying on this work that was happening in the United States and before that in England?
Not solely, but yes, to a large degree, in the sense that the eugenicists worldwide were very much in touch with each other. And one can go back to as early as 1905 to see correspondence with and shared collaborative research conducted with between Davenport and his associates in the U.S. and a variety of German scientists who went on to become the leading so-called racial hygienicists, the race scientists of Nazi Germany. One of these men was Ernst Röden, very, very closely involved with Davenport and Company in the 1910s and 1920s. In 1939, he's recognized by Hitler. He wins a medal for what he has done for promoting racial science. He's the one who writes the euthanasia laws for Hitler. Another collaborator of Davenport's becomes the rector of the University of Berlin, and on taking the position, purges the faculty of all of its Jewish members. So the connections were very, very real. Would the Nazis have done it without the Americans? Yeah, of course, I think they would have. But they used this to make it, yet again, make it acceptable. So you find in 1946 in the Nuremberg trials and the doctors' trials, you find the defense being used by some of the accused Nazi scientists saying, well, we were only doing what the Americans were doing. Look at their books, read their laws. It's all very similar.
And even though there is a recognition in the 1930s that the American eugenicist movement contributed to or, you know, helped influence the Nazis, there was still no move to change the laws that were in place that also came out of this movement?
There's a horrible moment in 1939 when Senator Robert Wagner of New York introduces a bill into the Senate to allow 20,000 German Jewish children to come into the U.S. outside the quota. Irrespective of the quota. And Congress votes this down. And at the time, this was a popular view. The anti-Eastern and Southern European views did not dissipate simply because of the Nazis. And it really took another generation to free itself from this poisonous thinking.
What was the opposition to this movement like? Was there an opposition to it?
Well, they're the two movements, so the eugenics movement and the anti-immigration movement. The anti-immigrationists were opposed by ethnic politicians overwhelmingly. There were exceptions. There were some, who could trace their roots back to the Mayflower, who believed that immigration should be open to all people. But largely, you would find the congressional delegations from the large cities, including San Francisco, Oakland area, New York, Boston, Baltimore, they were the leaders of the congressional pro-immigration group. In terms of eugenics, there were some scientists, some bold and esteemed scientists who tried to stand up to the eugenic steamroller. Leading among them was the great anthropologist Franz Boas, who from the very beginning argued strenuously that there was no scientific basis for any of these eugenic views. But he was dismissed by many because, well, of course he feels that way. He's Jewish. He's making a case for his own people. So to the degree there was a scientific opposition, it was pretty easy for the prevailing scientists of the eugenics mold to dismiss it.
Franz Boas is interesting, as you mentioned, serves as the founder of the discipline of anthropology. I believe a mentor to Zora Neale Hurston, who was an anthropologist herself as well as a novelist. But what, he was a sole voice?
Well, he was the leading voice. No, he was not the only one. There were people. There were some people who had liked the idea of eugenics early and then saw the direction it was going. Herbert Spencer Jennings of Johns Hopkins University. There were several who spoke out or who attempted to speak out, but their voices were drowned out by the crowd.
How about Margaret Sanger? I always hear sort of competing versions about Margaret Sanger in this story. And of course, Margaret Sanger was a great proponent of birth control, which would the founder of Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, she, in fact, the term birth control is one that she originated. The anti-abortion movement today argues in an effort to discredit Sanger that she had proposed birth control on the blacks of the South because she wanted to eliminate them. And there is a letter that is quoted over and over again in which two key sentences are left out to, that would indicate that that is not at all what she believed. However, she was a eugenicist, and as late as 1938, in her memoir, she continued to endorse the eugenicist position. She invited Madison Grant to come and speak at her conferences. She was very close to several other members of the eugenics movement. She made the case that one of the problems we have in our urban ghettos, the Italian ghettos in particular, these people are reproducing so fast, there are more of, that there'll be more of them than there will be of us. She makes this distinction. There's no denying that she believed in eugenics. And I think that there are a couple of reasons for this, apart from the usual reasons. One is that she was a zealot, and anybody who endorsed her position was somebody that she would be willing to do business with. And then secondarily, if you think about it, there really is a connection between birth control and eugenics in the sense, at least in this one sense, that they both are dependent upon planned reproduction, planned parenthood, planned breeding. So in that gray area between the two movements, there's quite a lot of overlap.
With eugenics, and again, you look at eugenics through the prism of immigration, anti-immigrant sentiment, immigration policies. There's also another side of eugenics, and that's more of a medical side in which people were sterilized, people were kept from being able to reproduce, people were considered to be disabled in some way. Important to note, when we say eugenicists here in the United States helped influence the Nazis, the Holocaust would actually begin with disabled folks, gay people as well. Did you dive into that side of the story?
Not a lot. There have been several recent books, very fine books, that do the sterilization story. It's, of course, it does figure in my book because you can't fully separate it. It did come from the same root. It was the attempt to purify the American population by eliminating certain people from the by making it impossible for people who are deemed inferior to reproduce. The sterilization laws begin around 1907, and they are in place into the 1970s, and more than 60,000 Americans were involuntarily sterilized. And this, now these were Americans who were wards of the state. They lived in state-controlled institutions, in prisons, in almshouses, in asylums for the insane, and other such places where there is the state is responsible for their so-called well-being. And in many states, I think it was more than 30 states, had laws that enabled there to be a medical determination made that, no, this person needs to be sterilized lest he or she will reproduce. And this was upheld by the Supreme Court in the late 1920s by a vote of 8-1. And again, among those eight were Brandeis and Holmes, who wrote the opinion in which he said, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And it's really chilling to think about that today. These were people who were denied this most basic of human rights, the right to perpetuate their own families, because of state interference.
Daniel Okrent, I did watch online one of your book talks about the guarded gate, and you said, talking about this history and looking at what's happening today, you said you like to let the leader, you said obviously there's connections to today, but you like to allow the readers to, you know, respect the readers to make up their own mind what that connection is. And I respect that, because I think that's oftentimes what we try to do on this show. But as somebody who did write the book, as somebody who did dive into this history, are you willing at all to talk about how you see a connection to today, to this history that you dived into?
Sure, of course. You know, I end the book with Johnson signing the law that gets rid of the quotas in 1965. He's on Liberty Island. It's a beautiful sunny day. He says that, you know, now's the time for us to honor what the Statue of Liberty means to Americans. And I write in the very last sentence of the book, for believers in the promise of the nearby statue, the future of American immigration policy looked as bright as the brilliant sun overhead. Now, it's always dangerous to end a book with irony, which is that was meant to be, because there are some people who have read it and said, what do you mean? How can you say it's brilliant and wonderful? It's terrible now. Well, yes, it is terrible now. And the connection, I think, is pretty obvious, which is when you make your distinctions on who can come into the country based on where they come from, on their nationality, on their race, or on their religion, you are doing the same thing that the quota law of 1924 did. So when the president looks at all of Central America and Mexico and dismisses these people as invaders, as rapists and thieves and murderers, it's not making a determination about the individual. It's making a determination about entire nationalities. Same with his earlier actions against immigrants from Muslim countries. It's not because this particular person is dangerous. It's because we think they're all dangerous. And though the argument supporting Trump's positions is not the same as the eugenic argument, the effect is the same. It's the same effect of making a discriminatory decision based not on anything more than one's feelings about a particular race or religion. And that's a dangerous and horrible thing. I think that it makes sense to have immigration laws. I don't believe in open borders. I think the American economy is, we go through a kind of sine wave of it's things being good, things being bad. And there are times when we really need more immigrants, and there are times when more immigrants can create more of a division of wealth in America. But to base them ever on race, religion, or nationality, to me, is a violation of the American promise.
Your publisher is Scribner. That's actually a part of this story as well, because in the early 20th century, Scribner, one of the most influential publishers of all time, was Maxwell Perkins, who was publishing books by eugenicists.
Right. This is something that is left out of Scott Berg's prize-winning biography of Perkins. Perkins may not have been any more prejudiced than others of his social class, educational level in his time, but he did publish Madison Grant, not just in 1916 and the revised editions thereafter, but he was still publishing Madison Grant in 1933 and many, many other scientific racists. You can't blame all publishers for taking the same positions that are taken in the books that they publish. But there's correspondence in the Maxwell Perkins files that very, very upsetting. When the book that Grant publishes in 1933, that he writes in 1933 and Perkins publishes, doesn't get a positive response, Perkins says, well, you know, the problem is that all of the reviewers in this country come from a certain group, which was a euphemism, so that they would be opposed to your views. Then he writes a few weeks later and said, books can do much better in Britain where the Jews have less power. This is 1933. It's at least an unsettling notion to think that Perkins believed this at that time.
Daniel Okrent has been our guest. Daniel Okrent is the author of the book, The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. He joined us for a conversation about anti-immigrant sentiment as well as policies towards white Europeans in the late 19th, early 20th century. Daniel Okrent, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you, Mitch. It's been my pleasure.